The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 17.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. I should mention, I didn't say this in the previous episode when I was doing the book review, but let me thank all of you who contributed to the show. I really appreciate it. And for those who want to get in on the action, go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute, and you can see all the information. Now, today, our guest is Alexander Tabarrok. He's the Bartley J. Madden Chair in Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and a professor of economics at George Mason University. He specializes in patent system reform, the effectiveness of bounty hunters compared to the police, how judicial elections bias judges, and how local poverty rates impact trial decisions by juries. He also examines methods for increasing the supply of human organs for transplant, the regulation of pharmaceuticals by the FDA, and voting systems. Now, Alex, many of you may know him. He's the co-author, along with Tyler Cowen, of the huge economics blog Marginal Revolution, marginalrevolution.com, where they also have launched their online platform, Marginal Revolution University, where they have lots of videos teaching economics. And together, he and Tyler also have written the textbook, Modern Principles of Economics. And Alex is more recently the author of an ebook, Launching the Innovation Renaissance. Alex has his PhD in economics from George Mason, and he was a Mercatus Center PhD fellow. So in this interview that I'm going to now share with you guys, it was a very fast-paced one where we couldn't hit all the topics there, but I did try to touch on a lot of Alex's research in ways that I think would be interesting to you guys. And I think it's just a good discussion between two economists, sort of geeking out. Hope you like it. Well, Alex, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Great to be here, Bob.
So as I always do with someone who's well-known in the libertarian free market economic circles, can you just explain to us in whatever detail you want to share, at what point did you know you wanted to be an economics professor, or did you lose a bet and that's what, how it happened? You know, we want to know, how did you get to be you?
Right. So I guess it traces back to Rush, the Canadian rock band.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Limbaugh, because that's my story. All right.
Yeah, no. I was having a debate with my parents one day. I grew up in the type of family where you would have debates around the kitchen table, and we were debating rock music and classical music and which was better, or which was rock music any good. And I pointed out, look, these guys, Rush, they're influenced by philosophy. You know, they recommend this Ayn Rand in Philosopher. And my mother said, oh, yeah, you would probably like her. And I think she's regretted it, you know, ever since. Because I felt bad that I hadn't actually read any of Ayn Rand, as I said at the time. Hadn't read any of her material, but that's how it started. And I went to college to do PPE, politics, philosophy, and economics. And
so, even at the undergrad level, like that was you, and you thought of it in that framework,
right?
Okay,
yeah, exactly, yeah. And I did that, but I ended up doing much better in economics than I did in politics and philosophy. It took me a little while to understand the standards and what they were looking for in politics and philosophy. I got better at it. But in economics, it took off right away. And so I was kind of set from that point on.
Yeah, I've noticed just even teaching at the undergrad level when I was doing that at Hillsdale, that there were some students, it's just the economic way of thinking clicked with them immediately. And other ones, and it wasn't like, oh, the smart kids versus the not so smart kids. It was a separate thing about just the way to think like an economist. Have you encountered that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a certain amount of sort of natural cynicism, perhaps, about human behavior. It's not exactly cynicism, but an approach to thinking about issues which makes the self-interest assumption and the economic approach, it just clicks with people.
Yeah, I guess if I had to crystallize it would be like being able to look at something from the perspective of an individual whose motivations or preferences or goals, let's say, would be different from yours possibly, and just to think through the ramifications of that. And so just like I think, you know, to be able to play a strategic board game or card game, you got to kind of think like your opponent and say, well, what are they going to do? I think some people have that ability and others don't. And I think that's partly what goes on. And when someone's able to ace, you know, the intermediate micro exam.
I think that's part of it. But it's interesting that the game theoretic aspects of it don't necessarily attune with somebody who is empathetic with other people, who can easily put themselves in other people's shoes. You know, I think my wife is much better at understanding my motivations, perhaps, than I am of her. Mm-hmm. But understanding the self-interest and the economics of it, I think I'm better at.
If you don't mind, let's try to figure that out then. So what's the what is the difference there that in terms of you were saying cynical? So it's not just enough about thinking like someone else, but realizing, like, for example, I remember in terms of picking, we were going to have a thing where I was working at the cafeteria in college, and we had to vote on who we thought the next student manager should be. And, you know, in other words, among the people who were the managers that kind of overseeing, so we internally were going to vote to see of us who was going to be like the head one. And I forget what the reasoning was, but it was a kind of thing where it was clearly between two people. And I remember one guy was thinking, okay, I'm going to actually give zeros to the person I don't want to win, because, you know what I mean? Like the way the voting system worked. And I think that's something where, a lot of people, it wouldn't have even occurred to them to do that. And like the headlady, like the adult who was kind of in charge of it and having us do this little voting procedure. Actually, it turned out the joke was on us. We selected one person and it wasn't the one she wanted. So she just overruled it. And so it was kind of like, ha, you know, you can have your elections as long as you pick the right person. Yeah. But is it that the kind of thing you mean where it just wouldn't occur to some people that, oh, wait, people might game the system and they just assume, well, if the rules say this and go vote for your candidates and rank them, that they'll do it honestly?
That's right. And I also think, like, if you think about politicians, for example, like Bill Clinton, I think was a person who was very good at creating empathy one-on-one. Everyone who met him says instantly, you know, they felt that he was paying attention to them and he was into them and was thinking about what they were thinking about and so forth. But I don't think he'd be a good economist.
Well, how do you – he might. I mean, he did bad things, but that's – thing you got to think like an economist, Alex. Maybe he's just saying that. I bet you he could get 100 on your exam. We don't know.
Maybe. I don't think so, though.
But if he can take a first derivative, I think he's halfway there. All right. Yeah. Okay, so at what point did you decide you wanted to be a college professor?
So my father was a professor. My father was a professor of mechanical engineering. So I grew up in an academic household. And so this meant, you know, we always had students around. So, you know, at Thanksgiving and Christmas, my father would have all these Chinese students or his foreign students. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoyed I got used to that kind of lifestyle, or I enjoyed having young people around and intellectual conversation. And, you know, my father took me to the universities, University of Toronto, and you saw, you know, all these grand buildings sort of looking like Hogwarts. This is before that, but, you know, these Gothic buildings and the life of the mind and intellectuals and people walking around on campus. This was something which I had grown up with and enjoyed. So it was pretty easy for me to become a professor.
Let me ask you this. Did you think you were going to be a college professor before you realized it was going to be in economics?
It was definitely in one of the categories. I thought a business or a college professor was definitely one of the categories. This is what the kids would say I was privileged, right? I mean, it is amazing that how many smart people don't realize that this is a opportunity open to them, and it's just something completely foreign. While to me and to my kids as well, this is part of growing up. Like, my kids have grown up with Brian Kaplan and Robin Hanson and mm-hmm. Tyler Cowen, and going to lunch with them and talking with them. And so that's been an incredible gift to my kids, I think.
Yeah, I remember that I always had these visions that when I was going to be a college professor, that I would go in and sit on the physicist lectures and I would just, you know, be this cosmopolitan. And it turned out I didn't have enough time to do any of that. But it still seemed like a thing I would want to do if I had, like, if I could clone myself. I would sit in on so many lectures, but...
I mean, as we often tell our, you know, graduate students, you have more time now than you ever will again.
Right.
And it's true. None of them ever believe you, but it is true.
Right. They keep thinking, oh, just if I can get through this, then in 3 years I'll be able to relax and work on the stuff I care about. And no, you won't. Or not as much, but yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, how then, I mean, you mentioned Ayn Rand, so... Were you from the get-go then, your interest in economics, would you have been like a fan of the free market, or did that come later?
No, that came very early on. I was certainly an individualist even before Rand, and of course Rand just filled it in. And then Rand recommended, Ludwig von Mises, mm-hmm. and so I started reading, Human Action. Human Action never quite did it for me, but Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a summer, perhaps I was 18 or 19, and I spent the whole summer just going through that book. And that really was an eye-opener for me. That was huge.
Okay, great. Did you do the whole pantheon of Milton Friedman and Bastiat and all that stuff, or were you?
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. And I did all of the week-long summer seminars. I was at Stanford or the Mises Institute mm-hmm. seminar. So I met Rothbard and got to know some of these guys. And so that was all great.
Oh, you did. So I actually never got to meet him. Can you just we have a lot of younger people not that I'm young and I didn't meet him. Is there anything like just what was that? I guess one thing is,
yeah.
Was it at that time? What time frame are we talking about?
This would have been in like the 80s, late 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Was he, can you give us an idea of how famous he was? You know what I mean? Like, would that be like,
I'll tell you,
like,
yeah,
John Stossel? Is that a good, in terms of fame or no?
No. Okay. No. So for example, I was thinking about graduate school. And I knew that, Rothbard was at Brooklyn Polytechnic. So I called them up and I asked them, can you send me information about your graduate school in economics?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we don't have a graduate school in economics. And I said, what? You have one of the greatest economists in the world at your university and you don't have a graduate school? So he was not famous, and this was pre-internet. So you couldn't, there was libertarianism and the free market, the book catalog, but there was no fame back then, right?
Okay. Okay, so that's one thing. I sort of would have guessed that, but I just wanted to clarify. And then now, I don't know how to put this, but in terms of just like you being in the room with him, like, were you thinking this guy is just like a legend, even though he's unappreciated, or was it just, oh wow, he's a really good economist? I'm just trying to gauge. How big a deal was it?
Right. No, it was a big deal. Yeah, it was a big deal for me to meet him. And what was very interesting, you had all these professors, and Rothbard wouldn't show up till late in the afternoon. He mm-hmm. liked to, he liked to sleep late, and he really got going, in the later evening.
Yeah.
And what was cool is that all the other professors would go to bed, they'd leave. And Rothbard would just be getting going and would want to talk some more. And so he often ended up hanging out with students. So I would like a couple of times, have the opportunity to like drive him to like a Denny's and mm-hmm. then, have like midnight, supper with Rothbard and, be just talking about economics. And so that was an incredible thrill to me to be interacting one-on-one. And he was so animated and enthusiastic.
Sure. Yeah.
And such a unique individual, and he gave so much of his time to students. He wrote me a few letters, so this was kind of a foundational experience.
Okay, wow, that's great. I mean, I knew you were at least sympathetic to the Austrian tradition, but I didn't realize that was such a key part of your formative years. That's interesting. All right,
yeah.
I put you on the spot.
I'm a member of the club, my friend.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's right. We'll check the record books to see when you were formally inducted. But so are there any anecdotes, anything that pops to you, like anything about it would, something that perhaps, no one's heard of before, just a funny anecdote of those years?
Well, connected with this is, I was at the University of Victoria in Canada. And I started with some friends a college newspaper,
mm-hmm.
the Campus Capitalist. And we would like print these articles against, you know, the minimum wage, and we would, you know, reprint, you know, stuff by Rothbard and some, you know, of the Objectivists. Mm-hmm. And so I was really proud of this. You know, it created a lot of excitement on campuses. People would go around and try and throw them out. I mean, this was
welcome the diversity of opinion. I don't understand.
Exactly. Yeah. So this kind of stuff goes back farther than last year. Anyway, so I was quite proud of this. So I sent the Ayn Rand Institute. I sent them, look, check out this campus capitalist that I'm running, because I was like holding, you know, they were coming and giving talks and mm-hmm. stuff. And we had reprinted some of the libertarians like Rothbard. And so I got this letter back that you cannot do this. You know, the libertarians are horrible people and you're out. And so I was excommunicated by the Ayn Rand Institute.
They didn't even give you a warning, or they just boom, like you, that was it. There was no.
Yeah, I don't remember all of the, you know, the legal niceties, but basically that was it. And so this, of course, you know, raised the Rothbardian group in my mind even higher, mm-hmm. because they had always been very welcoming and had not squashed down any of my questions or any of my deviations from orthodoxy. So
sure.
This is an interesting.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, can you give us, let me ask you now before I forget, just while you're talking about that, as I think, you know, I guess a little bit younger than you, and just in my lifetime, I have seen this immense explosion of interest in libertarianism and Austrian economics. And I think sometimes, like, newcomers, they don't appreciate, you know, how isolated it was. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, you know, in terms of just to explain to people, like, look at how far this stuff has come.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the internet has made, you know, every nerdy group, you know, be able to find themselves. And that has had a tremendous social impact, not just, of course, for libertarianism, but for all kinds of oddities, mm-hmm. and has accelerated a lot of things. You know, when I was coming up, yeah, I was just trying to remember, it was the Laissez-Faire book catalog.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember also I did one of these week-long seminars in California with the Institute for Humane Studies. And you know, Larry White spoke, and Randy Barnett. This was before Randy Barnett was famous, and so he gave a talk, and a bunch of others. And then at the end of the week, they took us into this room, and there was a long line of books, and they just said, "Help yourself to any book that you want, any books that you want." And this to me was incredibly exciting and thrilling, because it just opened up a whole new world. You had no idea that these books even existed.
Right.
I mean, it was totally hard to find, you know, libertarian books or anything like that. And, you know, it had to track anytime a new book came out. It was, you know, it was a really big deal that there was something new, and to discover something was quite amazing. And it was, you know, it was hard. Like, how would you get, you know, Hayek's books? It was like really hard.
Right.
Before, you know, Amazon and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think people, yeah, they just can't imagine. I mean, I remember when I wanted to get Human Action. So I was in high school at the time, and I had to call around. I eventually called the college bookstore at Hillsdale, because that was the only place, and they had to mail me a physical, you know, and that was the way I got it. And then it wasn't until I visited the campus of Hillsdale, because that's where I was considering, and I did go there. And up till then, I thought his name was Ludwig von Mises. Like, that's how I would say it. And then I, you know, talking to Ebeling, and he said Mises, and I was like, oh, okay. Actually, I think it was Gary Wolfram who might have been the first one I realized, oh, I've been mispronouncing that guy's name for 3 years. Okay. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great. And so then how did you, in terms of once you got your PhD, then what was your, I mean, I know you're at GMU at this point, but like, how did that happen? Like, what was your career briefly in that respect?
So I did my graduate degree at George Mason. Mm-hmm. So I was one of Tyler Cowen's students, and that was amazing. And I went out on the market. It was a tough year. I got a job at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, mm-hmm. which had a much better department than you would expect from the quality of the university overall. So there were some good people there. But I didn't particularly like living in Muncie, Indiana. You know, it was, again, this was like pre-internet. So you were like completely isolated.
Right, right.
You had to drive to Indianapolis a little bit over an hour to get to a Borders. Like a Borders, that was the sign of civilization, right? There was no Starbucks even.
I'm going to title this episode, Tabarrok Supports Borders, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Anyway, so the career was not going terribly well. And I wasn't particularly happy, but I had the opportunity then. I was asked to be the research director for the Independent Institute in Oakland, California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this was a big deal because typically when you get out of the academic market, it's really hard to get back in.
Sure.
But I felt, you know, when things are not going well, you want to throw some variance into the mix, mm-hmm. right? You want to take some risks. And so I did that. And went to work for the Independent Institute for David Throw, and had a great time living in Oakland. But I did manage to keep publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So I got papers published, and then I had this fantastic opportunity to come back to George Mason. I'd done some other things in between. I taught at UVA for a while and so forth. But that was the major thing. So then coming back to Mason was a huge deal.
Okay. That's great. So while you were at the Independent Institute, is there anything from that period that, you know, in particular you want to highlight or, you know, that stands out? And, oh, yes, that was a great, you know, period because we did this, and this, or anything like that that stands out?
Yeah. So, you know, one book which came out at that time was The Voluntary City, which I did some work on in editing. And that's been kind of a very successful in a book. I think it's become part of the sort of libertarian pantheon in a little bit. So I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, if I could stop you for a second. Yeah, because I did some of their summer seminars for the Independent Institute. I think I did it for 2 years in a row. And part of what I had to do was topics, you know, flowing from your book. And it hadn't been something I had read up to that point. And yeah, I was really blown away by that. And like how hardcore you guys were in that book, if you know what I'm saying. And so that was great stuff that I was showing, you know, your influence from Rothbard there, that you're willing to go for the jugular and, you know, let's not beat around the bush. Do you remember, there was a part in there that I really liked about like the hotel analogy. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, maybe just for our listener, because, yeah. You know, when I read it, of course, I was a adult anarcho-capitalist, so it's not like these, but just the application, the way you just made it sound so like, duh, of course this would work. You know, just like right. Think about how a hotel is. So yeah, do you want to just maybe for our listeners explain that analogy or application?
Right, right. So when you think about a hotel, you are basically, you know, renting a living space. And the hotel provides all of these amenities, including security. They provide, you know, heating and lighting. They provide even a kind of a legal system in adjudicating disputes. And so the hotel is like a mini city. And so you can think about hotels as sort of the, you know, original charter cities, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you make a hotel bigger and bigger and bigger, then you get to, you know, a privatized city. So you can also think about Disney World is a classic private city. It has its own transportation system. It has its own sewage system, its own garbage disposal system, its own police force. It's got, you know, millions of people over a year and tens of thousands on any given day are living in Walt Disney World. And all of these services, because all of the externalities are internalized, it means that Disney World can support all of these services based upon, you know, kind of the Henry George idea mm-hmm. of the increase in land rent for becoming a visitor to Walt Disney World. So it's a very efficient means of providing city services.
Great. And Tom Woods and I always remark too, when we're on the Contra cruise, that, you know, cruise ships also are a great example, especially like the big luxurious ones. Like, it's a floating city.
Absolutely.
And like you say, you know, if a crime occurs, you know, ultimately they're going to go to port and have the government police get involved. But, you know, on the ship itself, they have to have security. And, you know, so anyway, it is interesting how that works.
And the other thing you see on the cruise ship is people from all over the world are working there. Mm-hmm. So it's open borders in the sense of you have people from perhaps hundreds of different countries are working on this cruise ship, as well as customers from different countries as well. So it's a very open kind of system, especially when you get outside the 12-mile or 100-mile barrier.
Since you used the phrase, let me push you here, okay? And because I don't know how much you're aware, but I don't like that phrase.
Yeah, I know you don't.
So couldn't I say to you, Alex, Disney World doesn't have open borders. They don't just let anybody walk into the park. So your own analogy or application clearly shows that, yeah, you need to be very careful about who you let into your city. Couldn't I say that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I think about it is when we're talking, so for example, when we say, well, we want free speech, what do we mean?
Yeah.
Okay. We want a First Amendment. Well, it means we want restrictions on the government.
Sure. Yep.
We want, the government is not allowed to police what people can say. When I say open borders, I mean that the government, just like free speech, is not allowed to police where people can go, just like they're not allowed to police speech. Of course, in our own homes, then we have controls over speech. You're not right. allowed to shout outside, you know, or inside, you know, my home, whatever you want. And, you know, there's all kinds of controls on speech, but that's within the system of private property rights. So I think we just have to understand that we're talking about different levels. And when I'm talking about open borders or we should have free speech, I'm talking about restrictions on the government.
Great. And I like that answer for people. I mean, I've done, for my listeners here on the Bob Murphy Show, I've done immigration as a thing. So people know my stance. But for those who are tuning into this, I'm very much in agreement with the economics of the fact that letting more immigrants in, I think, you know, helps probably most Americans, particularly if we got more specific about how it happens. And I certainly don't want the political authorities regulating the traffic of human beings. It's just that phrase open borders. I thought, that isn't Brian Kaplan's an Eric Kaplan's. He wants privatize the borders. But I like that answer you just gave, because you're right. When people say free speech, they don't mean that, yeah, you can just take over newspapers and they have to print any letter to the editor. That's not obviously what people mean. So I do appreciate that. I guess my only concern is I think what most people, if you don't mind, let me just push you one step again on this. However, when people say free speech, though, it doesn't mean that currently we're in the situation where the government is in charge of what newspapers print and what television shows run and which books get published. And, you know, you're saying, hey, there shouldn't be any censorship. And then what you mean is, you know, people can publish stuff even if others don't want it published. So I guess it's tricky. Because in other words, right now, it's like the government controls the borders and then they wouldn't. It's not so much that what we're saying is we'd turn it over to private hands. Or are you saying that, no, that's not really the analogy? I don't know if I made myself clear. Do you get what I'm saying? How conceivably someone who's concerned about, quote, unrestricted immigration could say that's not really analogous to free speech, because it's not that somebody could have something published against their will. Whereas in the current situation, there could be people coming in because they're using the public land, and therefore it's not like the private owners even have a chance to stop it?
I would just say, I don't think this stuff is all that hard to understand. I mean, we have open borders between cities and between states. If you want to move from California to Nevada, you can. And
yeah.
So I think that we're just, when I say open borders, I just mean the border between Canada and the United States would be more similar to the border between California and Nevada than it is now.
Okay, yeah. I think that's perfectly reasonable. Again, I just wanted to push so we're getting to the heart of these issues. Okay, that's good. As far as that voluntary city, I remember the other one that I really liked was the issue of the roads, you know, the classic who would build the roads. And I don't know if off the top of your head you remember any of the details of that essay, but it was interesting just to show, again, another example where historically private market, like, you know, building the turnpikes and so on, they solved these collective action problems. You know, they weren't stupid. They understood, you know, they would go to local businessmen and they would have various mechanisms to get them to contribute because it would, you know, it would boost the traffic to the towns or whatever. Is there anything from that you remember that you want to relay?
So I would just kind of on a meta point is that, you know, we have this phrase in economics of market failure. But the problem with that is that you're prejudging the issue. You've assumed right to begin with that it's a failure, right? You say market failure.
Mm-hmm.
So what I prefer actually is market challenge. So you have these market challenges, and absolutely, you know, public goods and externalities, they are challenges to markets in the ordinary way that we think about markets. But sometimes those challenges are overcome. I don't necessarily say that they're always going to be overcome, but I don't want to prejudge the issue. So when we have market challenges with the externalities, let's go and see how are some of the tools which people, entrepreneurs in markets use to overcome these challenges. And often we find that there are ways of doing that, at least partially.
Yeah, very good. Well, why don't we transition then to, as we're continuing to go through your biography here, I think obviously what a lot of people know you as is one of the two, what are you? Are you a host of Marginal Revolution, the website? What's your title? How do you think of it? Are you the Baron? The Duke? What are you?
Yeah, I'm not sure. One of the writers, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that something, and I apologize, I don't know this. Did you and Tyler start that simultaneously, or did he start it first and you joined, or vice versa?
No. So actually what happened was I went to Tyler one day and I said, we should write a textbook. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're right, we should, but first we should write a blog. And he was right. That was the correct ordering. So we started out writing Marginal Revolution. And this really later on helped for us to produce a textbook. It helped in two ways. First, it gave us some credibility when we said we have a market and people would be interested. And we could point to Marginal Revolution as, you know, all these people reading it every day. And second, perhaps even more importantly, you know, when you're writing on the blog, you've got to get to the point quickly, and you have to convey some useful information, something of value quickly, because your readers are one click away from leaving.
Yeah.
So writing every single day and trying to make it interesting and concise and valuable so that you keep your audience coming back for year after year after year, that was an incredible learning experience, which we later adopted in our textbook.
Okay, I didn't realize. So it was just one giant marketing scheme the whole time. We're sitting here thinking, oh, they're teaching us economics. And really, it was just all about the dollars. I see. I like that.
Yeah, it was many years. But you could think about it as long-range planning.
Okay, but joking aside, I didn't realize that was the origin story of that. So that's interesting. Would you say, can you think back to, has your blogging style changed over time? Or, you know, if we grab blogs from you from – you know, yearly intervals, would we be able to sort them besides the, you know, if the content gives it away in terms of current events?
So I think the really big change was a very interesting period in intellectual history happened with the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And this actually was coincided with when blogs were at their peak. And I think if you go back and look at what was going on, you had all of these economists, my co-author, Tyler Cowen, Scott Sumner, Paul Krugman, Brad DeLong, all these people who literally were working out their economics on the fly in real time in front of an audience, trying to figure out what the hell was going wrong, why was it going wrong, what can we do about it? And so that was an incredibly exciting time in terms of back and forth between blogs and conversation between blogs. And that, in the current, after the Great Recession, that has faded away. So there's much less back and forth between blogs than there was before. So if I can write something and people don't respond on their own blog the way they used to, that's all gone to Twitter now.
Yeah.
So that back and forth has changed a lot.
That's once you said that out loud, like, yeah, you're right. That is exactly what happened. And it's interesting. The only thing I can remember in terms of my personal experience was, you remember there was that debate over the government debt and does that burden grandkids? And that was, it was fun how it was bouncing around.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another amazing example of that, in which you played an awesome role, I must say, with working it out all on a spreadsheet, which was very, very cool. The burden of the debt.
Yeah, thank you. You sent me a private email I sent something and you wrote back a very complimentary email. I thought, you know, this Tabarrok guy, he's all right. You know,
okay. I don't remember that.
But I do. That was a big component of my self-esteem to this day.
That was great. Yeah. You and Nick Rowe and others.
Yeah, it was just for those who don't know, and folks, I'll put it a link. So it's bobmurphyshow.com/17 is where you see these links. But yeah, it was, I'm not making this up. I was getting ready to write a thing in defense of Krugman that I thought he narrowly was right about. I know you know this, Alex, but just for the listeners, saying that the government debt per se doesn't burden future generations because it's just a transfer. That, you know, the ones who inherit the bonds receive the interest and the taxpayers pay it, but it's not like it makes our grandkids poorer or richer on net, at least if the bonds are held domestically. And I thought, insofar as it went, yeah, that's true. And then Don Boudreau and Nick Rowe were saying, no, James Buchanan showed that that's totally wrong. And I thought they were wrong. And I were, you know, Nick had this simple little example with, you know, apples and oranges in a two period model or something. And I went to prove him wrong. And I was just in a daze for like 2 days in a row. You know, so D-A-Z-E for 2 days, D-A-Y-S. And I was like, wait a minute. And it just, yeah, it took a while to recover from that. But it was a great thing. And you're right. We were all learning from the one guy who didn't learn was Paul Krugman. And that was how I knew he didn't read my blog, because people used to think, oh, I bet you Krugman. And I'm being serious about this, because Krugman, he's not stupid. And I knew if he had seen those Excel spreadsheets that you're talking about, Alex, he would have realized, oh, I got to be more careful. So in other words, he could have maintained his position, but he could have tweaked, you know, the argument. Because that's what Dean Baker did. Dean Baker at some point said, oh, okay, yeah, I see what you guys are saying, but empirically, come on, that's not the thing. And he kind of just switched and, you know, sort of contained the damage and moved on, whereas Krugman kept repeating the fallacy over and over. So I knew, right, he doesn't read my blog. I can't believe it. I guess, you know, you win the Nobel Prize, you don't need Bob. All right, so yeah, there you go.
That's an interesting case, actually, of a hugely important economic issue, which it's not at all resolved like with math or, you know, being taking some complicated derivative or some model or something like that. It's really all about getting these almost philosophical foundational issues right and just clarity of thinking. And it's very, very difficult. And I don't think that debate actually will ever sort of go away. I mean, you know, despite your massive clarification.
Well yeah.
Because it's just so easy to get it wrong.
Well yeah. To me, what I would say happened there is, you know, people were making some simplifying assumptions, as economists often do. And one of the assumptions was, you know, the fact that not having the generations overlap. Because if you don't have overlapping generations, you can't get the result, you know, that Buchanan and Nick Rowe that I was formalizing in those Excel spreadsheets. You need to have overlapping generations, otherwise you can't do it. And so just something like that, where you would assume, well, let's assume the generations don't overlap and just, you know, everything happens this period and then this generation hands everything over, the debt claims and the physical assets and blah, blah, blah to the next generation. If you do it like that, Krugman's result seems true. And so I think, you know, you don't realize how much work that assumption was doing, and that's driving the result.
Right.
And so the example of that. Now, you said something, and I found this as well, that, yeah, there was a period where blogs were big. And now, yeah, like if I'm on an airplane or something, I'll read the heck out of, you know, your guy's blog and Scott Sumner and Econ Log and so on. But I can go days without doing it, whereas now it seems like, you're right, Twitter has supplanted that, but also podcasts. And is it, I think people's just attention span. I mean, also, I used to write really long, well-thought-out essays on email to people.
Right.
I used to send gorgeous emails. Like they were, you know, literary masterpieces. And now you're lucky if I use the shift key. So is it just that the attention span now has gone down, or what do you think?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure. I mean, you could say the attention span has gone down, but then the other example of podcasts are like longer than ever, right?
But you can multitask. I think that's the issue, is that I realize, oh yeah, I can be doing something else while this is playing, whereas I can't just stop. And for me personally, even like can't justify sitting there and just reading blogs for an hour, whereas I can be in the car and listen to a podcast.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is. Interesting how even within this brief time span, we've seen the evolution of media, which is happening faster and faster. I think, yeah, with blogs, you know, it's basically more or less us and Krugman in terms of writing like consistently. Blogs, there's not many left who are writing more or less on a daily basis.
Now, since you mentioned it, I will say, I'm wondering what your reaction is. Whatever you think of his perspective, and as you know, probably I disagree strongly with Scott Sumner's views, very strongly, but I mean, it was amazing when he first started blogging, you know, saying the Fed is too tight. This is the tightest monetary policy since Herbert Hoover. you know, and that was his ultimate explanation. I know it's very nuanced and so on, but I mean, basically saying the cause of the Great Recession, the reason we're stuck in the slump is because the Fed's being too tight when they're doing QE and interest rates are zero. And people thought he was nuts, and that he's, am I wrong to think he is one of like five people on planet Earth that really changed the way a lot of economists think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an incredible example. I mean, not to knock Scott at all, but I mean, he's at Bentley. He was at Bentley. Mm-hmm. He's nowhere, right? I mean, he's totally unknown. He was a totally unknown. He published some few pieces, of course, but I mean,
yeah,
he was totally,
I'd never heard of him. I had no idea who he was. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, just through sheer force of personality and will and logic and drive and repeating the arguments and coming up with new ways of challenging and developing the arguments, he has just done a Herculean task, and he has definitely moved the profession. I mean, it's incredible that this guy out of nowhere, through blogs, not through journal articles, and in real time, you know, this has happened as you and I have watched, he has really moved the profession. It's pretty much unprecedented, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've been consistent from day one. I said, no, that's totally wrong. And I still say it. And I've just watched other people falling over. So either I'm wrong this whole time or eventually I'm going to say, I told you guys. But whereas somebody like Brad DeLong, it really annoys me that when Sumner was first doing it, DeLong and Krugman were just dismissing him. No, the Fed's out of ammunition. We need fiscal. And then when all of a sudden it became cool to believe in NGDP targeting, it was like, oh yeah, we've been saying all along that that's the way to go, and Yellen agrees with us. And I'm like, what the? No, you weren't.
Yeah, it's insane.
You were throwing Sumner under the bus too. We were on the same team back then. Jeez.
Absolutely. The great forgetting. Yeah. I mean, Brad DeLong and Krugman were, completely. It's only fiscal policy can work, right? And they have really switched on that. That's absolutely the case. Scott Sumner's book, by the way, on the Great Depression is also very, very good. That also I had some hand in at the Independent Institute. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that to your listeners.
Yeah, I will put that there. And then I will also put my largely critical review of the book as well, just to make sure we get both sides. But yeah, sure. Certainly, and I've said this before, that I would be much more afraid of debating Scott Sumner. I mean, I would do it, but I would want to have really want to prepare, as opposed to Krugman, that, you know, I could debate him next week. And I think, you know, I would be able to, you know, catch him and contradict. Whereas Scott, he's thought through it. I mean, in other words, I think his views are crazy. I mean, I would say that, you know, that the problem of the Great Recession was the Fed was too tight. To me, no, that's not it. But he can back that up very well. He's got a very internally consistent thing. He's got a lot of data to support his view. You know, a lot of times he would say something and I would think it was wrong and I would go look it up and say, oh, he is right. That, you know, that is what happened with, you know, break-even inflation rates and stuff. So, yes, Scott is definitely a formidable person. And I think that, it's amazing. And like I say, regardless of whether he's right or wrong, for sure, when he started with his thesis, everybody thought he was nuts. And now it's like more and more at these Jackson Hole conferences where people are talking matter-of-factly about, oh, yes, you know, NGDP targeting and, you know, and targeting the forecast and things that he has been talking about. And it was sort of interesting. And like you say, it's not that he was some huge heavy hitter. It was just he just kept boom, boom, boom.
So, and actually now the opposite error is being made, is that now you have all this ridiculous people, you know, arguing that, the problem is that the Fed is keeping inflation at 2%. And if only it were 4%, everyone's wages would be going up much higher and we'd all be happy. We'd be living in nirvana. And they've got it completely backwards, is that, you know, in 2008, 2009, that was, if you think that the Fed could have been effective, it was back then, let's put it that way. And that at that point, they were saying, no, the Fed is out of ammunition. As you said, you know, interest rates are zero. There's nothing they can do. And yet that was the time when the Fed could have been effective. And but today, everyone is saying, oh, the Fed needs to do more. And yet today is exactly when, you know, we're in equilibrium and the Fed, you know, is really quite powerless at this point in time. And yet, because of the politics, I think we're now in this situation where people are saying, oh, the Fed is the is the controller of the economy and can do anything that it wants.
Right. Well, since you brought it up, I'm just curious to get your take. So where we are, so we're recording this in early February of 2019. The Fed has, it's been raising interest rates for some time now, but it was really only in 2018 that they started letting their balance sheet shrink. And you saw a lot of volatility in the markets in the last, you know, third and fourth quarter, let's say, of 2018. And now recently the Fed has not raised rates. The market soared and people are saying, oh, is Powell backing off? Again, we're not going to hold you to it. I know the future's uncertain, but in your opinion, like, is the Fed able just to stay pat for another 3 years, or do they, are they kind of need to be continue tightening?
Yeah, I think actually at this point, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think the Fed has much less influence in normal times than people think, and that in normal times, it's the real economy, technology, capital, and labor, and that's what determines GDP, and not the Fed is just determines nominal variables. And there's very little, we're at full employment, there's very little the Fed can do. You know, when you have a recession, particularly when you have a great recession, that's when there is a case for monetary policy, menu costs and sticky wages and sticky prices and all that kind of stuff. That's when the case is. But, you know, there's no case for monetary policy now. As long as they don't do something stupid, they have very little influence over the real economy.
Okay, so I guess I don't know what your macroeconomic views are. Do you not buy that? And it's fine if you don't. It's, you know, you're not here to judge or argue, but do you not really buy the Austrian theory of the boom bust cycle?
Not. I mean, I think it's complicated. Look, there's a great desire to have one theory of the boom bust cycle, right? Mm-hmm. One theory to rule them all. And I just don't think the world is like that. I think recessions are caused by different things at different times, okay. And different recessions are caused by different things. So it's not that I think that the Austrian theory could never hold. In some places and sometimes it may be one of the factors, but it's definitely not the only factor. And so I don't put a huge amount of weight on it as opposed to a variety of other things.
Okay, let me ask you this. This is the way to get to the heart of it. So right now, you don't think the economy is like this giant structural house of cards that's been built on misallocations over 7 to 8 years because of artificially low interest rates. That's not the way you're looking at the world right now.
Correct.
Okay. So in your mind, if the Fed and the government did more reasonable policies going forward, there's no reason that there has to be a giant crash. That's not like built into it.
Correct. I don't think it's built in. Correct.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
That's my view.
Okay.
I trust the markets more than you do, Bob.
I like that. Okay. Because you're saying if there were going to be a big crash and a bunch of people knew that, then that would already be priced into the stock market. That kind of an argument?
Partially, but I also think that the markets can adjust to what the Fed does. And so that we are not at the behest of the Fed. I mean, it's a big player, but real interest rates are what matters. And I think real interest rates are predominantly determined by markets, not by the Fed.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you, doing rapid fire topics here. You mentioned earlier that the whole impetus for the website was that you wanted to do a textbook. So you guys do have, you have a micro and a macro one. Am I right?
Correct.
So can you talk about, and by the way, I really liked I've read your micro one. I don't know that I probably have the macro. I haven't looked, but when I was doing research for the book Choice, I remember I was, you know, I got a copy of your book when I was in the beginning, just trying to see how do people define economics, and I needed that. So your guy's book was very good. And if I were teaching those classes, I would seriously consider using it. So can you just give us, you know, any bits of, for other economists out there, like in terms of they're thinking about doing a textbook, any kind of words of wisdom about the process for how do you go from having, hey, we should write a textbook, to the finished product that's, you know, high quality?
Right. So the book is Modern Principles of Economics, and we have micro and macro, and it's competitive with, you know, Mankiw and Krugman and so forth. So I would say a couple of things. You know, people ask, well, how long did it take to write the textbook? And I say, well, 50 years.
Right.
And there's a lot of truth to that. It's a lot harder than it looks because you have all of these models in your head, and they all sort of use slightly different assumptions and slightly different notation and things like that. And when you come to write a principles book, you've got to make it all consistent and coherent. And that's really quite difficult. And I'd also say this is kind of funny, is that there's nothing that will get you to dislike the market more than having to serve it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we went into it initially, well, we're going to do this and we're going to, you know, teaching is bad and people are doing this the wrong way and doing this the wrong way and so forth. And you quickly get a lot of pushback, right?
Right.
Is that professors are not going to adopt your book if you don't do things the way that they've sort of always done them. So you have there's a more limited amount that you can do than you think you can do. And of course, you're always pushing against that envelope. You want to do some new things to attract, you have to have some innovation and some product differentiation. But there are also things, you know, for example, you know, there's this long thing about the average variable cost and, you know, the dropout decision, and if the firm is above average variable cost, they don't. But even if it's above average cost, and people love to teach that. It's completely useless, but people love to teach that. And
my quick anecdote on that is when I was teaching at Hillsdale, it was principles of micro, and doing all the cost curves and all that stuff. And it was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks into the semester, and I gave them a quiz on, I can't remember the exact thing, but it was like, you know, here's the situation the firm faces. What should it do? And it was the kind of thing where if I had asked them on day one, their common sense would have given the right answer. But a bunch of them, because they were trying to do it in terms of drawn curves, and they gave the wrong answer. And I realized I have given them negative knowledge.
Yeah.
Like I have made them worse economists by teaching them these curves and everything, because now they can't use their common sense and they get the curves wrong.
Exactly. And of course, they forget that material very quickly. So the tagline for the book is "See the invisible hand, understand your world," and that's really what we try and do. You know, it's not called the invisible hand for nothing, because most people can't see it, and economists are some of the few people who can see the invisible hand, which I think about as the times and places and conditions under which self-interest leads to the social good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to, and understanding that idea, understanding when self-interest leads to the social interest, that's really the root of civilization. If that were not possible, we would not be able to have a civilization at all. So understanding that, I think, is incredibly important for students. And economics is the only place where you're going to learn that. You know, you can learn, you know, how to take a derivative in your engineering classes, in your math classes. You're not going to be able to see the invisible hand unless you've taken some economics classes. So that's one of the things which we put emphasis on teaching.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's a point that Mises would make a lot, that to say that, you know, economics is its own field. You know, I think he would call it a science, and we can, you know, people can quibble about what does that word mean, but yeah, it's, he was saying there's results, you know, patterns of things that happen in society that are covered. It's not math, it's not history, it's not the physical sciences, and well, it's economics, you know, and it's, there is a bunch of results there. And you can see it so amazingly on Twitter, like very smart, intelligent people, perhaps leaders in their respective fields. And if they don't know economics, if, you know, if they haven't at least taken a principles class, they just spout stuff that's so demonstrably wrongheaded, and they have no idea because they've never taken an economics class.
Yep, exactly.
Folks, let's take a break from my conversation with Alex Tabarrok to talk about the stock market. It's been bouncing all over the place, probably got a lot of you guys a little worried. So what can you do? Wouldn't it be nice if there were a place where you could build up wealth that was largely immune to this volatility and yet wasn't some nut job thing like Bitcoin, which Alex and I are going to talk about later in this episode? I got it just for you. It's The Case for IBC, a book I co-authored with Carlos Lara, Nelson Nash, where we talk about using properly designed whole life insurance policies as a way to build wealth, to manage cash flow in a totally boring, old school method that anybody can understand. Go to thecaseforibc.com for more details. Okay, well, with the time I have left with you here, why don't we hit some of the main areas of things you've written on or worked on? I know the FDA is a big one, right, in terms of your recent work. So do you want to tell the listeners, like, what's your project there?
Sure. So I think the libertarians are probably familiar with the basic idea that the FDA, there's a cost to the FDA. that sure, there may be some benefit to doing, you know, more testing for longer periods of time, but you also have to look at the trade-off, is that this means that good drugs take longer and are more expensive to get to the market, as well as the bad drugs being more likely to be weeded out. So that's kind of a, just the basic idea of that, oh, there's a trade-off. And this is, just like you said, if you don't understand any economics, you probably have never even thought of that there might be a trade-off.
Right, right.
Might be something to think about there that, oh, you know, the FDA might be doing too much safety testing, right? To imagine that you could have too much safety, right? That if you don't understand economics, that just the idea of too much safety, how is that even possible, right? So that's kind of the basic insight. But now what I brought to it, which other people had not, is that, you know, many people ask, well, what would this world look like if we had, you know, less FDA? How could we even imagine? What examples do we have? And what I point out to them is actually right now we have a virtually unregulated system of pharmaceutical prescriptions, prescribing, which is entirely outside the FDA. And this is the off-label system. So kind of amazingly, actually, once a drug has been approved for some use, it can be prescribed for any use at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wouldn't be important except for the fact that old drugs often have new uses, and the new uses are often completely different than the old uses. You know, we suddenly, through serendipity, discover that this drug we've been using for a long time, you know, for eye care, is also good at treating liver cancer, mm-hmm. right? To give one example. And what happens is that as soon as there's some information in the peer-reviewed literature and so forth, doctors can start to prescribe this old drug for this new use without that new use having to go through FDA efficacy trials. So right now, there's this entire system of off-label prescribing where doctors are prescribing drugs for uses which have not been tested in FDA-required efficacy trials. And some people, a few consistent ones, say this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we need the FDA to regulate off-label uses. But if you go and ask physicians, and my co-author Dan Klein and I have done this, what do you think about a policy where physicians could not prescribe off-label? They say that would be crazy. And the reason they say that would be crazy is because it's often the gold standard of treatment in AIDS and cancer and other rapidly moving fields is often an off-label treatment. And so they say patients would be much worse off. So here we have this unregulated system sitting right below our noses, and it works, I think, remarkably well, according to physicians.
Do you remember, I remember because I wrote The Primal Prescription with Doug McGuff and we got into a lot of this stuff. I could be wrong. I want to say that Viagra and certain things for male hair loss were that pattern. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, so that was a case where it was a heart disease. It was being tested for heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And the patients would come in and say, well, I don't know what's doing for my heart, but you know, my head, it's doing a lot. Mm-hmm. I got all this hair. And so it had a new use.
Okay, interesting. So that's great. And I haven't read some of your FDA stuff, but I don't think I've ever seen you just, you know, crystallize it like you did there. So that's great. Let me just be devil's advocate. Couldn't someone who's a defender of the status quo say, no, Alex, well, he probably said Dr. Tabarrok, what we have right now is it's still, though, these things that are being prescribed for different uses, they had to get through that initial hurdle to make sure they're safe, you know, defined in some way. And so now that we know these things don't cause crazy side effects, yeah, go ahead and use it for wherever you want. And it's not so much that we want to make sure that they – even though, yes, ever since, you know, the thalidomide thing, there was a new standard of efficacy, but still just in terms of being safe and not having some poisonous product on the shelves at CVS or to be prescribed, you know, that's what the FDA is there for. And so, you know, you're by you saying, oh, you don't see people dying in the street from this. Yeah, it's because they went through that initial barrage of scrutiny. And so we know relatively safe things are the only ones even in this universe that then could be prescribed for different uses. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so I'd say that's correct. These drugs do have to have gone through some safety trials. Now, I'd say two things. First of all, moving the FDA so that it no longer has authority over efficacy trials would be a huge, huge step.
Can I stop just for once, just for people to know? So efficacy means that it actually is good at achieving something. So that doesn't mean safety. So it's not, the question isn't, is this thing going to kill you or not? It's just, is it going to achieve the ostensible purpose? That's what to be efficacious means. Just, okay.
Yeah. And prior to 1962, that's all the FDA did, is basically safety trials.
Right.
After 62, they got all this authority so that they could say, we're not going to permit your drug on the market until you have gone through these efficacy trials. And those trials are the really expensive ones, because if you have something, you know, like a statin, for example, to avoid heart disease, you've got to follow thousands of people for many years, you know, half of whom get the statin, half of whom do not. And you got to follow them for many years until enough of them have had heart attacks so that you can tell, you know, the difference,
right,
if there was a difference between those two randomized groups. And that's just really, really expensive.
And
so
it
raises the cost. It takes time, a long time, and it's very expensive. So pushing the FDA back so that there were fewer efficacy trials would be a big step. And that is what off-label suggests would be possible. The second point I would just make real quickly is that no drug is ever – the only drugs which are safe are the ones which don't do anything.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's never a safe drug. Any drug which has an effect also has a side effect. So when we're talking about safety, we're always talking about in the context of treating a disease, a comparative kind of a judgment. So even a drug which has been through safety trials, that doesn't mean that you can take it and have no effects.
But yeah, that's great. I mean, and it's Doug McGuff, my co-author in that book, he was relaying in the chapter when we talk about this stuff, something he learned when he was in medical school. And I'm not going to do it justice here, but you know, he had some legendary doctor that gave these principles. And it was like, all drugs have effects, you know, and so they're all side effects. You know, to say a side effect means, oh, that's not what we wanted. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of like, you know, there's teleology involved. Like, you need to know why are you using it? You know, Martians looking at it might not know it was a side effect. They might say, maybe that guy, you know, wants to have six fingers. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know,
that's, so the point which I would make, which would sort of summarize this, is that there is a whole apparatus of approvals which is going on outside of the FDA system. Mm-hmm. There are physicians, there's the peer-reviewed literature, there are hospitals, there's Kaiser, HMOs, and they're all evaluating drugs, both for safety and efficacy. And it's that whole system which is operating, you know, alongside but outside of the FDA process, which we also rely upon when we are treated for medical care. And people kind of forget that there is this entire approval system which is operating outside of the FDA.
Now, are you familiar, what do they call it? Is it freedom to try? Is that the catchphrase?
Right to try.
Right to try. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you just tell for our listeners who don't even know what that phrase means, can you just explain what that is?
Right. So right to try, it says that patients can have a right to try experimental drugs before they have been approved. And I think sort of right to try has been very, very popular because it's easy to explain, mm-hmm. right? And so it's passed in most states, and it just passed, Trump passed it at the federal level. But it really doesn't get at the key issue, which is you have to lower the costs of drug research and development and getting a drug to market. So today it costs well over $1 billion to get the average new drug to market. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get more drugs to market, you've got to do something about lowering those costs. And right to try, it doesn't do that. I mean, right to try just says that, you know, some patients, you know,
that's what I want to ask you. Like, do you have to have like a terminal illness or something? Like, it can't just be anybody, right? Otherwise, that would kind of throw the FDA out the window.
That's right. And the drug firms also have to agree, and they're reluctant to agree because if they give a patient who is not within a clinical trial, they give them allow them access to this drug, and then the patient dies, they're worried that the FDA is going to then use that information against them.
Right. Whereas if they have a proper thing with, you know, 10,000 people and half are a placebo, then you could get a better idea of the statistics and say, well, you know, statistically, this many, we're going to die anyway. That kind
exactly.
Of thing.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So it really doesn't address the major issue, which is reducing the cost of research and development and getting a new drug to market.
Okay, well, I remember when I was doing that book with Doug, we got into a little bit of, you know, the kidney markets and things like that, and you had done some work on that. And so just again, to me, that's just a great thing of like a crazy economist having a free market in kidneys. Are you out of your mind? And just to where within 3 minutes, I think, of that debate, you put the person back on his heels where you can just show and, you know, look at all the consequences and, you know, who are you to say da 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 da, you know. So can you, just for someone who's never entertained that idea, you know, justify what kind of crazy nut job would want there to be a free market in kidneys? Are you out of your mind?
Yeah. So look, here we have this fantastic case where the owner of the kidney, who is dead, has, you know, almost no value on it. And yet there's somebody else out there who places a tremendous value on this kidney. So this is an incredible case of the virtues of trade and how trade can make people better off, because you have one person who puts a really low value on it and the other person who puts a really high value on it.
So you're thinking of it mostly just in terms of people sign something saying, if I die, one of my kidneys is salvageable.
Yeah, so that's okay. One way of doing okay. it. There's a whole bunch of different ways okay. of doing it.
Because you just said dead, and that's why I want to clarify for the listeners.
No, okay. Another way of doing it is you could have a gift for the gift of life, right? So often phrasing these things in ways which is non-repugnant.
Right.
You know, we don't say buying and selling the kidney, but if you said, here's a gift for the gift of life that somebody who has died, motorcycle accident, opioid death is now a big one. If their kidney is donated and to give life to somebody else, we'll cover the funeral expenses, right? Mm-hmm. And look, this could even be the state, the government covering the funeral expenses, because this is an unbelievable case where for kidneys, for example, right now, the government covers the cost of dialysis, and a kidney transplant is cheaper than dialysis. So you could cover the funeral expenses, you know, give some compensation to the kidney donor, okay, and still the government could save money and save lives at the same time. So it's really a win-win situation, and yet we're having trouble getting there.
And what's interesting, and I don't know the exact, but I know like in terms of like adoption and things, how in surrogate motherhood, you know, there's regulation that, you know, like you can't just pay someone to do it, but you are allowed to pay for her to get top care medical treatment, you know, during the pregnancy. And if she has to take off from work, maybe there's a thing where you can pay, you know what I mean? And so, but you can't just pay for it, you know, because that's
right.
And so like this here, do you know like what the regulations are that if you identify, you know, like, oh yeah, this guy over here needs a kidney and I'm a suitable donor, he can't just give me $50,000 to pay for me to agree to do it, but he is allowed to defray my out-of-pocket expenses and things like that, right?
Yes and no. So I think we need to separate out the buying and selling. So there's, you know, there's one possibility, which is to have a completely sort of free market mm-hmm. in kidneys. But there's a whole bunch of other steps which we could do to improve the market and save lives before we get all the way there, if we ever want to go there.
Right.
So, for example, we could compensate the donors, okay, creating some incentives to donate, and still have the decision about who gets the kidney stay exactly the same as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Allocated by medical need, okay?
Right.
Not by, so the buyer, the person who gets the kidney would not be paying, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it would go to, you know, the person who has the most points on the list, who needs it the most and so forth. So we could do that, right? And still improve the market situation considerably, you know, without having anybody buy a kidney, without having, you know, the rich guy come in and, you know, buy the kidney. I'm not saying that that necessarily would be a bad thing, but I'm saying that we could get most of the benefits of a pure market in kidneys simply by compensating the donors and increasing the incentive to donate.
Okay, so you're saying when you look at the current situation, the screaming inefficiency and craziness of it is all these people taking perfectly good kidneys into the ground with them.
They're burying them and burning them.
Yeah. Okay. When, you know, clearly that, okay. So it's you, that's the important thing. That's the thing that needs to change. And then once you have all these extra kidneys now to work with, how they're allocated to you. Yeah. In a perfect world, you know, you'd use markets there too, for the reason we use markets for lots of stuff. But you're saying to you, that's the critical thing.
Yeah. I think we could get, you know, 90%, 95% of the improvement would just be increasing the supply. That's really the bottleneck, right? We need to increase the supply. Right now, you know, every year, some 5,000 or 6,000 people die while waiting for a kidney. Another 5,000 or so are moved off the waiting list, and then they die pretty quickly. So that's like about 10,000 people a year. And actually, that itself is an underestimate, because lots of people are never put on the waiting list because doctors know they have no chance of getting a kidney. Mm-hmm. So when you sort of add that all in, we're talking about 30,000 people a year dying who could live considerably longer lives if the supply of kidneys were greater.
Okay. And then just with a normal mortality and thing, how many people die a year from just random stuff. And you're saying, you know, if they have one or two kidneys even that could be salvaged, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Oddly enough, one of the countries which has a more efficient system is Iran. Mm-hmm. And Iran, they have a kind of a model where it's run by a charitable nonprofit. And so the donors and the recipients do not meet. There's no exchange between them. But the nonprofit compensates the donors. And these are live donors. These are not cadaveric donors. The nonprofit compensates the living donors. And they've been able to essentially eliminate the waiting list in Iran.
So the Iranian system is more radical than Tabarrok's recommendation.
It is. Yeah, that is correct. That is correct.
Don't you need to get out of the beltway? Doesn't that alarm you?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting. So I guess, I mean, I made the joke there, but do you find that a lot? So why don't you take a shot then at, you know, would you think that, you know, libertarian to people who see the virtue in what you're talking about here, that rather than just going to the extreme case, which is going to freak people out and talking about, hey, buying and selling kidneys, you just go to eBay and, you know, that you're saying, no, that's what's going to horrify people, to just do a more gentle, like, let's package it differently. And why don't we do incremental steps that's actually going to achieve something in the next 5 years and might save a lot of lives. And not obviating the long-term total freedom. It's just, you know, it's steps along the way. Is that the way you're looking at it?
Right. So like incremental steps, saving a lot of lives. Like, how would you describe that? Like, it'd be marginal, maybe marginal. Oh, marginal revolution. That would be it.
It's either that or Fabian libertarianism. Okay. Yeah, I get that. So that's, by the way, do you remember, did you guys jointly come up with that phrase? Or I don't want to put you on the spot in case it's a trade secret, but who came up with that?
That I came up with the name. And of course, it has multiple meanings, which is useful. Marginal revolution, referring to Menger and Jevons and the marginal revolution in economics and economic history. It also, of course, has this nice military intelligence, marginal revolution. It has a nice contradiction there. Right. So it has some meaning. And also, I felt it described Tyler and myself, sort of, I was more on the revolutionary side, believe it or not.
Right.
You've been pushing me on the marginal side. Tyler was more marginal, but together we're marginal revolution. So I thought it fit on a number of different measures.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about the oxymoronic aspect of it in terms of, that marginal revolution, that those do sound like a funny term. I never thought of that. Interesting. All right, good.
Jumbo shrimp,
right,
marginal
right,
revolution, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think the last topic, if you've got time for us here, is you've done a lot of work on Bitcoin, I guess cryptocurrencies more generally. So do you want to summarize what sort of things have you been working on there?
Yeah, so I got involved in Bitcoin and blockchain because some companies came to me and asked me to give them some advice and to be a consultant. So I've actually been learning some of this material because of that. It's clear that in this space, there's a tremendous amount of chaff among the wheat, right? I mean, there are so many white papers which are promoting sort of ridiculous schemes, blockchain this, blockchain that, you know, X on the blockchain, Y on the blockchain. Nevertheless, I think you and I would probably agree that there's some potential there for really quite revolutionary and very new ways of organizing human behavior. And that's what I think is fascinating about it. This combination of cryptographics and economics, sort of crypto economics, creates new ways of incentivizing and organizing human behavior, which I think is going to be important as we move forward.
Now, I know some people, it's funny that I've seen some proponents, like huge fans of Bitcoin, also actually ironically agree with Krugman's take in a sense, where Krugman was saying, yes, the blockchain idea is interesting and it might have applications, but we just don't need it for money. And I've actually seen some fans of Bitcoin saying, no, the real revolution here, the true technological or conceptual innovation was this idea of the blockchain. And it just happened to be applied to Bitcoin, you know, in the beginning, but no, this goes way beyond that. And 100 years from now, people aren't even going to care something. Bitcoin's not going to be a big deal, but it's the blockchain. How do you feel on that issue?
Yeah, I think currency is just one application. And this tokenization of a whole kinds of different things, I think, is going to be important. This use of tokens to incentivize. It could be a different way of running a Facebook type of company, a different way of running a Dropbox type of company, a different way even of running a firm. You know, we have these experiments with these decentralized autonomous organizations, which is running a firm, but in a much more decentralized way than has ever been possible before. I think those have some a real potential to, again, change the way human action is organized.
I mean, can you just give us an idea? So right now the firm, you know, using Mises' understanding and Coase and whatever, that, oh yeah, it's got different subdivisions and Mises, they give some general parameters, but then say to the division manager, go make as much profit as possible without, you know, hurting the business, the image or whatever of the rest of the firm. And they go do that. And then you got the internal cost accounting. What does blockchain technology give that we can't just do right now with the current structure?
Yeah, so I think the analogy here would be to say that a decentralized autonomous organization to a firm is going to be analogous to sort of Wikipedia to Encyclopedia Britannica, right? So Encyclopedia Britannica, the firm, you had one person at the top, more or less, you know, directing other people, you know, write this entry, you write this entry, you do that. And Wikipedia is this more spontaneous evolutionary process in which you get, you know, potentially millions of people from all over the world contributing to create a encyclopedia. And there's no real boss, you know, and it's done on a much more decentralized basis. And what we've seen, of course, is that today there's no question that Wikipedia dominates any encyclopedia which has ever been created in the entire history of the world. It's better than anything which has ever been before. And there's that potential to do that for firms.
And the way that would be, quote, regulated is through blockchain tokenization?
Through blockchain, through tokens, through new types of voting procedures that you could do on the blockchain. You know, I'm being a little bit vague here on purpose because I don't think we know how this could be done. But a lot of my my colleagues' work, Robin Hanton, his work on prediction markets, I think prediction markets cohere very nicely with the blockchain. So we now have, in the case of Augur, these decentralized prediction markets, which can be used to get estimates of future events for all kinds of possibilities. And you can see how combining that with smart contracts, which are executable contracts on the blockchain. With prediction markets, they're going to do, so the contract is going to say, if, you know, X happens, then do Y. You'll be able to organize things in a new way.
Okay, very interesting. So the last thing I want to ask you, can you, you recently tweeted, or it was, I think it was, well, you tweeted it and it was referring to a blog post about that, hey, I think, I'm paraphrasing you, but you were saying, I think a lot of fans of Bitcoin believe it's more secure than it is, or something like, am I?
Right.
So can you, for the listeners, at least give your warning, just so I can say that I did my part to raise the alarm?
Yeah, sure. Let me say, first of all, by the way, that your book with Bartos, Understanding Bitcoin, I think that's an excellent book. It gives the best kind of intuitive conceptual understanding of Bitcoin that I've seen. So anybody who doesn't want to quite get into all the cryptographics, they should read your book because I think it does a very nice job.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll put the note. So it's understandingbitcoin.us, but I'll put a link. And yeah, it was Silas Barta was my co-author on that. And yeah, he did the cryptography stuff and I did more of the economics. But yeah, it was thank you. Appreciate that. See, I like this guy. This guy Alex knows what's up.
Yeah. So to get back to your question, Satoshi, you know, Nakamoto kind of made this argument that it would be difficult, even with kind of if you controlled a large fraction of the computing power of the Bitcoin network, it would still take you a long time to reverse the blockchain, which is what you have to do in order to double spend. And the kind of argument he made was, well, the probability of you, this is getting technical, winning the block reward, getting solving the hash function first is pretty small. And you have to do this multiple times, you know, in order to reverse the blockchain to double spend. Now, what Eric Budish, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, Booth School, and some others have pointed out is that kind of Satoshi uses this probabilistic argument. But when you actually turn to economics and you ask what would be the economic cost of pushing the blockchain back so that you could do a double spend, it turns out that the economic cost of doing that is really very, very low, especially today when you can actually rent computing power, hash power. And the more popular Bitcoin becomes, the more value is exchanged on it. This means that a double spend attack becomes, you know, really quite potentially quite profitable. And since the cost of renting the hash power is actually quite low, and if you rent that hash power and you push the blockchain back, you get all the block rewards. They go to you. So actually, it's really profitable to do a double spend attack. Not only do you get the double spend, but you get the block rewards. And so it turns out that economically, I think Bitcoin is less secure than many people think.
Okay, and you know what I'm going to say, and but just for the listener, because when I first heard you summarize that argument, you know, because if I was concerned, I was like, is there something? And it sounded like, you know, the guy was saying, okay, so let's assume first of all that someone's got control of half the network, computing power of the network, and then look at what they could do. And my reaction was, well, yeah, but didn't we know all along that somebody who had half the computing power, but wasn't the point that it would be really difficult for someone to? So in other words, when you're saying how it'd be expensive economically, that was never even the way I thought of it. And maybe you're saying, well, that was in the white paper from the get-go, and maybe I missed that element. But yeah, to me, it was always just more of a practical thing. Like, how could somebody, as Bitcoin grows in popularity and more computers join in the network, you know, how could one bad actor, even coalition, you know, take over half of it?
Yeah, so I think you have to then rely very strongly on that argument that it's too decentralized to get enough hash power to control the network. But that just looks wrong now. It just looks false because not only, as I pointed out, can you rent a lot of hash power, mm-hmm. but the mining pools are now so big that it only takes, you know, one or two of them getting together to have 50% mm-hmm. or more. And then the double spend attack becomes really profitable. And Bitcoin may be the most immune to this type of attack, mm-hmm. but there's lots of other coins. And any coin which uses a proof of work similar to Bitcoin can then rent hash power, which is, and there's lots of it floating out there in the world now because of Bitcoin, and completely dominate any of these other coins. So I think these other coins are really, really susceptible mm-hmm. To this kind of attack. And as you know, the day after I wrote my post, there was an attack on Ethereum Classic, exactly as I had described. So this was a, you know, case of, I just happened to have Marshall McLuhan in the room. Right?
Now, is it?
I got lucky.
Do you think it was a coincidence, or do you think there was a reader of Marginal Revolution who said, oh my gosh?
Yeah. No, I think it was probably a coincidence. It wasn't me. Let me put it that way.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Well, Alex, thank you for your time. We should probably end on that note. Where should the listeners go who want to read more of your thoughts and follow you?
So two things I would say, of course, Marginal Revolution and also Marginal Revolution University, which is where Tyler Cowan and I have created this online platform for economics videos to explain economics. And so if you want to learn economics, we have a whole principles of microeconomics and a principles of macroeconomics course. And we have more courses coming along the way.
And is that all accessible from marginalrevolution.com? They can see links for everything?
Yeah, you can find the link to Marginal Revolution University at Marginal Revolution. Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for your time, Alex. For you folks listening at home, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.